You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lisa wide tōku ingoa. No mai here mai ki te wai mo tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 9th of July. My name is Lisa and I'll be your host for the day while Oscar is out of town. But we also have Raul with us today. How are you? Well, it's better if I turn your mic on. So there you go. You can see how you're doing.
Kia ora, hello. I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Ah, you're very welcome. Coming up on the show today, as per every Tuesday, we will have Mangrove Mitch's Green Desk. This week, we look into how to reduce the production of methane in living organisms. Then, Raul, can you tell me what you're going to talk to us about today?
Yeah, I'm speaking with Leo Koziol, who's curating a Māori and Pacifica program at the NZIFF, short film program about Indigenous film in New Zealand and abroad.
That sounds really interesting. We'll look into that just after the first ad break. When we come back, we'll look into the world of short-term lending, and that is following a court action against lenders by the Commerce Commission for bad practices. And finally, I will be back again with the International Desk, and this time I'll take you to Greece. There was a snap election on Sunday, and the radical left party Syriza, that had been in power since 2015 and credited for taking the country out of a huge economic crisis, has just been beaten by the centre-right. All right, remember that you can catch all of these stories and more on the go in your car or when, you know, you do your chores. All you need to do is go on the 95BFM website, click on the BigCast section and make your pick. But if you want to share your thoughts with us while we're still on air, please feel free. Tuku Patui Mai, you can text us on 5395 or just give us a call in studio on 309-3879. All right, it's time for the Green Desk.
Kia tau te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai au e awhinei I a tātou, tihei Māori ora. This is the Green Desk on 95BFM.
It is indeed the Green Desk, and this week Mitch speaks to University of Otago Dr. Sejumwa Morales, sorry. Him and his team have made some discoveries on the reduction of methanogenesis in organisms. And if it sounds fancy, don't worry. It is the process in which living organisms produce methane. And so the first thing that Mitch asked Dr. Morales is, what exactly is this new process that he's discovered and how does it work?
So essentially, to kind of give you a bit of background, so inside the rumen, certain organisms, in this case, they're specific type of microorganisms called archaea, and they're responsible for producing methane, the process of methanogenesis. And so those guys, in order to produce methane, need to consume hydrogen. Now in the rumen, there seems to be more than one type of organism that can actually consume that hydrogen. And so normally when we try to mitigate methane emissions, we're focusing on those methanogens and we're trying to eliminate them. And so either prevent their activity or prevent them from being there to begin with by either developing inhibitors or vaccines or things that basically prevent them from producing methane. But what the research that we just finished basically showed is that there might be an alternative approach, that instead of targeting those methanogens, what we can do is actually target other organisms that can consume the hydrogen. So essentially, we create competition. We cause these other organisms to outcompete, outconsume the methanogens so that instead of the end product being methane, you produce something different.
So you've got the research there. How is this going to play out in farms?
Well, I think that we're still quite a ways away from actually using this information to deploy it to a farm level. But for instance, it might mean selection of different animals because of breeding that naturally have a tendency to have more of these alternative pathways than of the methanogens.
So,
or it could be something like some sort of treatment that can be given to an animal to shift the microbiome of that rumen from more methane to less methane-producing organisms. So there's lots of different potential avenues, but at this point there isn't any product that is even remotely close to being ready to be deployed to a farm.
Right, okay, yeah. And so in that, is it possible to sort of create like a fortified grain or something that sort of does creates that competition for you?
I don't know. I think that this point we don't really have the answer to that. What we know is that we have now the evidence to show that these guys are competing and that there is a clear sort of pattern that those sheep that have lots of methanogens produce lots of methane, and those that have less methanogens are thriving even though they don't have the methanogens because they have these other organisms. So it's a valid strategy. Now we just need to figure out how to make that shift within an animal.
Of course. And so in your research, was there sort of cases or something where you could see the reduction in the production of methane when the other hydrogens and things were out competing them?
So I think that what our study actually did is not to manipulate the rumen, but actually look at the rumens of a range of animals. And then we selected the ones that were either very high or very low to see what was so different about those organisms. So it was just natural variation within a herd of animals. So now the next step would be to try to manipulate a single animal to make them either higher or lower emitters. And so that wasn't part of this project, but it's going to hopefully be some of the work that we're going to be doing moving forward.
So have you guys had any sort of bites or nibbles on funding and things like that to keep going with this work?
Not at this point, but we're all still working under funded work, and the next stage in the research is essentially testing this. So starting out very small and just doing it, competing two organisms against each other, and see if it's valid. If we can then show that this is actually a valid mechanism, then scale up to a whole animal and see if we can manipulate to increase that competition.
Oh, that's awesome. And I just want to talk about, because you guys are obviously working with the Global Research Alliance, is that right?
Yep.
I don't know if you're allowed to speak about it, but is there any other sort of projects along this kind of scale in terms of facing emissions and things like that and greenhouse gases and stuff?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, the work that we just recently published is part of a big international collaboration. It included people from here, from Australia, from Japan, and it's just one of many projects that have been funded through GRA and through the New Zealand government. I'm actually involved in other research for different greenhouse gases. A lot of the work in my lab actually focuses on nitrous oxide, and that's the secondary or the second dominant greenhouse gas in New Zealand because of agriculture. In this case, it's from soils. So urine from animals lands on soils and eventually comes out as a greenhouse gas. And so it's, again, ruminants are the source of this gas, but instead of being directly from the ruminant, it's coming through the urine that's landing on the soil and then getting transformed. And so that's also funded through GRA, and in that space, we're also part of international collaborations looking at different technologies and management practices to try to reduce emissions from farms.
That's cool. Have you guys made any headway with those sort of projects yet?
It's a little bit more complicated because when we move from the rumen to soils, the complexity of the system goes up hundreds or thousands of fold.
Yep.
So it's instead of having thousands and tens of thousands of organisms, you have millions. So the challenge just gets incrementally bigger. And so at this point, we're actually, probably 10 years or more behind where the rumen research is, in that we don't even know exactly what's happening in soil. So we're slowly chipping away and now painting a picture of what's actually happening in soils and what leads to those emissions. So we're hoping that, maybe 10 years from now, we'll be doing similar discoveries as the ones that we're doing for the rumen.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
That was indeed The Green Desk with Mitch Fuller talking to Dr. Sergio Morales from the University of Otago. Remember that if you'd like to listen to this interview again, or if you've missed the start, you can find the story and so many more as a podcast on the 95BFM website.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You're still tuned into
95BFM, the Tuning Fork and Under the Radar present Southern Fork Americana Fest. October 10th to the 20th at the Tuning Fork. New Zealand's greatest Americana Roots Festival is back for its sixth year and better than ever, featuring
The Felice Brothers, Poké LaFarge, Tammy Nielsen, Johnny Fritz, Joshua Headley,
and many more. The Southern Fork Americana Fest, October 10th to the 20th at the Tuning Fork. For full lineup and tickets, go to southernfork.co.nz.
How do you impart a lifelong love of discovery with a 15-second ad?
The Science Roadshow is at MOTAT this school holidays, chock-a-full with interactive exhibits and two live shows.
That'll do it.
On now till July 21st. Normal MOTAT admission fees apply.
Let there be light. Yeah. Now a bit more though. Yeah, touch more. Ace.
Tūrama is Auckland's new immersive inner-city festival of light, jam-packed with dazzling light installations, projections and interactive sculptures. But it's not just lights. Tūrama has performances, film, food, drink and music from the likes of Yokozuna and Ed Zicolo, turning Albert Park into a brilliant winter wonderland for one magical weekend. Tūrama Festival, July 26th to the 28th, Albert Park. And completely free to attend, thanks to Trustpower. Find out more at 95bfm.com.
Oh, Rachel Ashby from BFM. The old brimful of Ashby. Ashby to Ashby, funk to funky, eh?
Well...
http://  thebomb.com/Ashby.
Yeah, just Rachel's good, eh?
Put some pep in your step and a twinkle in your eye. 95BFM Breakfast with Rachel. News, views, tunes and interviews. And a light sprinkling of producer Tess. 95BFM Breakfast with Rachel. Every weekday morning, 7 till 10am. Thanks to Orcom Broadband.
Sorry about what happened just before. I haven't hosted a show in a little while, so I'm getting a bit confused with the buttons, and I hope you didn't miss the beginning of your ads. Quite important. Anyway, we are going to play this great interview that Raoul just did and talking about culture. So there you go, Raoul. It's your turn.
The NZIFF is on the horizon, and with it comes the Ngā Whanaunga Māori Pacifica Shorts program, curated by Leo Koziol, founder and director of the annual Wairua Māori Film Festival. I spoke to Leo about the program he and guest co-curator Craig Farsi have put together this year, and we further explored the relationship between Indigenous film and the communities and cultural context in which this cinema is produced. I began by asking him about how the Ngā Whanaunga program was initially conceived.
Okay, well, so the Wairua Māori Film Festival has actually been going for 15 years now, and for that period of time, we've had a relationship with the New Zealand International Film Festival. They've let us screen the Māori films down in Wairua before screening in the big festivals in Auckland and Wellington and across New Zealand. And so about 5 or 6 years ago, we formalised that relationship, and so myself and Craig Farsi of the Pollywood Film Festival now curate a Māori Pacifica-specific collection for the New Zealand International Film Festival every year. And really, you know, it's a platform to uplift Māori filmmakers, to uplift Pacifica filmmakers, and give them a special focus within the festival. It's just so great that Phil Gosden made that decision to give them that amazing level of support. And each year it's just really gone from success to success.
What's coming up in the program this year?
Oh, well, we've got such a great program this year, actually. There's some real gems there. And, I mean, I guess kind of I'll start with the first film on the program called Our Atoll Speaks. So Gemma Acubero is actually a filmmaker, a Mexican filmmaker based in Los Angeles, who lived in with the people of the Puka Puka Islands and the Cook Islands Nation for a long period of time and made an amazing meditative film about how the people of Puka Puka see their greatly threatened island chain. And so actually, the most amazing part of the film, it's a beautiful film, stunning cinematography, all of the words of the poem in the film are from the people of Pukapuka. And the most amazing thing is when the film ends, the credit rolls and the name of every single person in Pukapuka who was involved in the film is listed. It's an amazing film.
And as you mentioned, you've been involved with the Wairoa Film Festival for about 15 years now. How did you get involved in the Indigenous film community within New Zealand?
Oh, I guess I've been a part of it all this time. I've always had a great interest in film. I've started being a bit of a filmmaker myself too more recently, but my focus and my first love will always be curation. And so, you know, it's quite a dream really to see. I'm quite a strong believer in the idea of a collective consciousness. So when we end up getting, you know, a dozen or so short films, you often see patterns and themes coming through similarly in different films. But I guess for me personally, of course, I am Māori. I come from a small village called Nuhaka on the east coast of New Zealand. So I grew up there in the 1970s with a real love of film. And so, you know, really wanted to bring my home community, you know, into the light. And so every year we have the Wairoa Māori Film Festival down in Nuhaka in Aomarae and at the amazing Gaiety Theatre in Wairoa. So Wairoa is a small town of about 5,000 people, and they've got an old cinema there that didn't get torn down. So it's a beautiful old theatre called the Gaiety Theatre, and so the council and the community rallied around and protected it. So we have a wonderful festival every Queen's Birthday weekend in Wairoa, and then the films go on to screen at their world premiere at the New Zealand International Film Festival in Auckland.
What are some of the narratives and themes that are being explored by Indigenous filmmakers, and what is the relationship between Indigenous film in New Zealand and the fact that this is being produced in a post-colonial settler nation?
For starters, you know, you've got to say that for Māori and Indigenous people and Pacific people, we are kind of true believers in a bit of a magical realism of the world. And so, you know, we're very aware of spirituality and our connection to nature and to the universe. Māori have more recently celebrated the Maramataka, and so we connect to the moon and the stars and the sun, and we realize that our lives are influenced and affected by them. And so when you watch a film and all of a sudden one of the characters is an ancient god from ancient history, for Māori we don't see that as something unusual or out of the ordinary. We actually see, well, gosh, that's a reflection of real life, because, you know, every day in our lives, particularly in our connection with our whānau, at times of birth, at times of death, at times of grief, at times of joy, we all come closer to what each person would have described as God or their gods.
I've seen it written that Indigenous film allows communities to be in control of their own representation. Do you find that to be quite true in the New Zealand context?
Oh, absolutely. And so it was Merata Mita, who was the first wahine to make a feature film in Māori, and then it was Barry Barclay, who was the first filmmaker in the 1980s who dared to say, actually, we'll make a Māori film by Māori for Māori, with a full Māori crew, script writers, producers, everything. And we see that in the program for Ngā Whanaunga this year. So in Ngā Whanaunga, there are three short films, one called Ani by Josephine Stewart Defew, Ways to See by Jessica Sanderson, and Rue by Awanui Simich Pene. Those three films were produced by the Ngā Aho Whakaari Aho Shorts Pod. So it was actually Māori producers that made these films happen and presented them to audiences. And also, you know, more and more filmmakers like Paula Fetter-Jones with Yellow Roses are embracing a tikanga Māori process in their filmmaking process. So absolutely, it's Māori now telling our stories. Barry Barclay had a term, camera on the shore. So the filmmakers are turning the lens back onto the world and saying, actually, this is the way we see the world. This is that way that we as an Indigenous Māori people see the world out there.
I suppose there's almost a shift, isn't there, from, I guess, representations of Indigenous peoples in the films of the past are sort of from an almost like an ethnographic point of view where they're exoticized.
Yeah, well, I guess there's kind of two or three layers to that. So, like, you know, in the past it has been an ethnographic representation, and so either the Indigenous people are romanticized as, you know, as the bosomy Polynesian maiden, or they're demonized as the evil savage to be succumbed and but there's always been, of course, layers of race there. So if ever you had a romantic story between a white person and a Polynesian person, often it would end tragically with the woman having to throw herself at a volcano or something like that. And then of course the second layer, of course, is Indigenous people telling their own stories. But I guess another part of it is when you are going into communities that don't have those filmmaking skills. There was actually a stunning film called Tama that was made in, I think, the Solomon Islands of the remote community, and people lived traditionally there. They managed to make some of the local people actors, but the directors were non-natives, but worked in such a sensitive way to tell their own stories.
I was reading an article by authors called Joe Smith and Sue Abel, where they talk about the history of how Māori television grew out of a decade or so of agitation on behalf of Māori activists who wanted to, as I mentioned before, have that control of media representation. I wonder what, if any, relationship is there between the development and conception of Māori TV and also the Indigenous film community in New Zealand as well.
Well, I guess each is their own beast, film and television. Film exists in the world of film festivals, and you know, there always used to be the disconnect between video and film media, but now, of course, everything's gone digital and everyone talks about screen production. But I guess kind of in cinema, in the filmic world, there's always a striving for a level of art, of high art. Television is primarily designed to entertain, whereas cinema is looking to become an artistic achievement. And, you know, I'll kind of reflect back on what Barry Barclay posited. He said that actually we need to think of a fourth cinema. So first cinema, of course, is Hollywood and mainstream fare. Second cinema was art house cinema that came out of Europe in the 1940s, 50s and 60s. And then the third world cinema was the third cinema. So he's saying fourth cinema is actually Indigenous cinema. It's about Indigenous voices. And, you know, and so there's certain parables and mythos around Indigenous cinema that look at the world a wee bit differently. So much more in tune with nature. You know, really being a voice for Papatūānuku, a voice for the future of our planet, and you know, and striving for something beyond. And so absolutely, television is our media that will bring our reo back, and cinema is the medium by which we can uplift our souls.
And do these films allow a dialogue between Māori and Pacifica in New Zealand and also other Indigenous communities who are making their own films from their own context overseas?
Oh, absolutely. Well, so there's an Indigenous film festival circuit now. So the biggest Indigenous film festival in the world is called Imagine Native. It's held every October in Toronto, Canada. And if you go there, you will find it's a convergence of Pacifica people, Aboriginal Australians, the Sami people from the frozen norths of Europe, and of course all the Indigenous peoples from across the Americas, from across what they call Turtle Island. And so, you know, there's a global Indigenous movement for change. We actually had a huge Indigenous conference in Kirikirirua, Hamilton, 2 weeks ago, and there was well over 20 Indigenous filmmakers from Canada there. So we grow and we inspire from each other. And of course, the thing that must be acknowledged is that the folks in Canada and elsewhere look to Aotearoa, look to Māori as a progressive place that has embraced and supported Māori filmmaking at a much higher level than their communities have. So they followed our model and are doing are starting to do as well as we are and doing amazing things, particularly Australia. Aboriginal filmmakers are right at the top level. Their films are screening in the Cannes Film Festival, the Berlin Nale Film Festival. And, of course, Māori, well, you know, we've got Taika. So you know, and we've had Whale Rider, we've had Wonderful Warriors, and since the days of Barry Barclay and Meta Tamita.
And when and how can we see the Ngāwhanaunga shorts this year?
Okay, well, so Ngāwhanaunga is playing on the 21st of July at the ASB Waterfront Theatre. Go and buy your tickets online at nzif.co.nz. It's going to be a really exciting event. I think the Puka Puka community in particular are going to show up in force to support our Atoll Speaks film. The Puka Puka Islands are actually an archipelago of islands that not many people know about. And if you look across the Pacific, there's a lot of island chains that are actually quite separate from their main community. So they kind of have their own universe and world and traditions, and so it's just so wonderful to see them recognised in this film.
That was Leo Koziol talking to our producer Rahul about Indigenous films and so much more. Remember that you can communicate with us either via text on 5395, or you can also give us a call in studio on 309 3879.
The Wire.
Alright, let's carry on this show with sort of a double piece. Payday Lander Mula is being taken to the High Court by the Commerce Commission on allegations of breach of responsible lending practices between 2015 and 2017. Mula, which also trades under the website name needcashtoday.co.nz, offers loans of up to $5,000, sorted of rates that can go up to 625%. And while this isn't illegal, the lending company is believed not to have done their due diligence in researching their client's ability to repay these loans. So I first talked to Tim Barnett, who is the CEO of FinCap. It's an umbrella organization that provides budget advice. FinCap released a research earlier this year looking into multiple short-term lenders with alarming findings, and it is FinCap's referral that actually led the Commerce Commission to take action. So I asked him about the results of this research.
We're a national organisation supporting 200 local services around the country, and they see about 70,000 people a year who are in financial hardship. About half those people have had one of these high-cost short-term loans, often more than one, and often it's gone as far as the debt collector. So they're in the debt spiral. So the work happens on the ground. It was in Christchurch Budget Service that somebody came in, and they got a loan from Mula, and it looked like Mula had not behaved responsibly, and that complaint was taken through by the local service. This is back in like 2015 to 17. That was the period involved, and it's taken another 2 years to go through the system to the point that the Commerce Commission have enough evidence to move ahead with a prosecution of Mula.
But it's not an isolated case, is it?
Oh, no. So, I mean, around 35,000 people a year, about 70,000, have these loans, and in the high-cost model, which is basically interest rates of 100% or more, this is pretty common. So they're supposed to do affordability tests. Most tests aren't normally done well, if they're done at all in some situations. They're supposed to make sure why the people are getting the loan, what the reason of it is. They need to make sure that people aren't going to be in hardship trying to repay it. And in this case, it looks like there have been a whole range of charges that have been brought, because it looks like, from the allegations, that Mueller's processes have failed. And that's pretty typical of the 20 or 25 companies who work in that area. We've asked around our services to see what they think of that sector, what they think of these high-cost loans, and their response is that 90% of the services say this causes much more harm than good.
Yeah.
And they'd rather they weren't on the market. And that's why we're going for a law reform to try and achieve that.
Yes. Before I touch on that, the Mueller's defence that I've read in other media outlets is that basically they're saying that there were no fine prints, no hidden costs. Everything was clearly displayed on their websites, or they sort of made sure that people would realise that this is what they were getting into, and so therefore it's not really their responsibility. What do you think of that?
Well, in fact, when we did the survey earlier this year, services reported that most people they were working with had a poor understanding of their rights. So it's one thing putting stuff in small print and parading it on a website. It's another thing making sure that the individual really understands the really high risk nature of the product that they're accessing. And by high risk, I mean that an interest rate of 400 or 500% means that repayments on even a loan of 500 are quite considerable. And if you get into trouble, you're very quickly into default fees. And from there, the evidence is many people go for another loan to repay the previous loan, and that's the spiral they get into. So absolutely, the company is going to claim that they did everything properly because that's their defence. But we think this is pretty typical of this sector, that the product is innately an unreasonable product to have on the market because of the risk of people defaulting. The whole model is predicated on people either paying very high interest rates or defaulting and getting into trouble. And that's why these companies rise and grow very quickly, and if they're then found to have broken the law, they tend to disappear.
You were talking about taking this matter and sort of turning it into law. So the government has presented the Credit Contracts Legislation Amendment Bill earlier this year. It passed its first reading. It's now in the hands of a select committee. And so, if I'm not mistaken, it aims to cap the interest rates, right?
No, it doesn't. What it is aiming to do is to say if you borrow an amount of money, you won't repay more than twice that amount. So if you borrow 500, you won't repay more than 1,000. But that can be over a short period. And the interest rate can still be hundreds of percent. So we like what the government is saying in terms of that provision, but we want to add on to that an interest rate cap. And if you do the two together, then we feel that's actually starting to address the real issues.
What about all of the additional fees as well? Because one thing that I saw going onto Mueller's website is that for every single operation that you can do, there is an extra cost to pay. But those are not in part of the bill.
They should be reasonable. I mean, those fees have to be defensible at the moment. And the law reform, is tightening up in a number of those areas. So the affordability tests are going to be more transparent than they are at the moment. So our financial mentors can work out what the company have actually done, if anything, to check on affordability. And also the need for fees to be transparent and fair is being focused on in the legislation. But that does that. I mean, that adds an extra complication to everything. So it's not a simple transaction of borrow the money and pay it back, because, as you say, every single stage you're paying more, and that's the nature of the model. And I guess at the end of the day, we're making a moral point that do we really want a product where so many people fall into default, where the financial hardship caused is so great, when there are alternatives around which would become easier to operate if this product or these products didn't exist?
Yeah. One last question. Mueller reacted to that bill earlier this year by saying that if you put these into place, then it would actually make it harder for their company to kind of keep offering those attractive and very easily accessible short-term loans, and that they would, I suppose, in return, make it harder for people to have access to those products. What do you think of that, and do you think it's realistic claim?
Well, I think it's the role of governments and parliaments to say there are certain activities and products in our society that are so unreasonable and cause so much harm that they shouldn't be available. And that's the point we're making in regard to these products. Yes, they look attractive. Yes, they may be convenient for some people. But when 90% of the experts on the ground, the local budget services, are saying these are harmful products, I tend to go along with their judgment because they're seeing the other side of this whole equation. So the legislation is heading in the right direction, but what it needs is to have a realistic interest rate cap added, which doesn't affect most of the loan companies, doesn't affect the banks, and encourages microfinance and others to take over the market, but does say some of these models are just so abusive and cause so much harm, they shouldn't be there.
And as Tim Barnett just said, short-term lending isn't the only solution for people in need of cash. Less aggressive schemes exist to help people out of these unforeseen costs. Nga Tanata Microfinance is actually one of them, and unlike the other programs, there are no extra fees or interest on their loans. While Mueller claims that capping the interest would actually basically make the whole financing scheme system collapse, I wondered how Nga Tanata could offer such loans, and so I asked its executive officer, Robert Choi.
Firstly, we're a charitable organisation, so we receive our capital that we on-lend from Kiwi Bank as part of their sort of social responsibility work. And we receive support from philanthropy or charitable organisations to support our operations. So we're able to provide our loans at no interest and no fees. But also the intent behind what we do is very much around the whole sense of social justice and ensuring that people have a safe and fair and affordable option from those like Mueller and others that lend at high interest. So we're there to provide an alternative and a safe alternative for people rather than getting into the traps of high interest and high fees that you've described. So we come from a very different not-for-profit perspective, but also recognising that people on low incomes, really once they get caught in those interest interest rate traps and get behind, they really struggle, as you've seen in the Mueller example.
This is why you offer those debt relief loans that are specifically targeted at sort of getting out That's of right. this vicious yeah. circle. You maybe give me like an example of a profile sort of the people that contract these debt relief loans? How much debt are they in, and how long has it been going on, and how did they get there?
Our target group for our loans is really those who are on low incomes. So they would probably be, a lot of them would be on a work and income support or low income wage earners. And I guess they've got there because they barely have enough, in fact, you could even argue they don't have enough to make ends meet being on a low income as such. And so when sort of the emergencies that happen to all of us occur, you know, the car breaks down, the fridge packs up, children are sick, the day-to-day emergencies and life events, that causes them to need to borrow if they can't borrow or obtain finance from whānau or others or friends. And so that's when the lenders that are out there make it easier for them to borrow money, and therefore they get caught in that trap. So already the challenge for them is that they've barely got enough for their own, for food and the essentials for the whānau. And so the challenge is therefore that they don't have enough really to be able to meet those emergencies when they come, and therefore that borrowing is necessitated, and that's how they get caught.
One of the allegations against Mueller is that they haven't done really their due diligence in finding out whether their clients could repay the loans that they were contracting. That seems obviously like one of the main things that those companies have to do because of the very fragile nature of the income of the people that contract those loans.
That's right. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. They, being an online lender and promising that they can deliver a loan within a very short time frame, it's quite hard to imagine how they can actually undertake their responsibility to assess a client's ability to repay. And also there's the suitability of the loan as well that they need to assess. They would struggle to do that, and therefore they would be acting irresponsibly according to the legislation and the Responsible Lending Code.
Speaking of legislation, you've expressed your desire for a change in legislation for quite a while. And so what are your thoughts on the Credit Contracts Legislation Amendment Bill that has been initiated by the government recently?
Yeah, I think we're very supportive of the fact that the government is undertaking the changes that they've suggested. And I think there's a lot of merit in some of the areas that they're trying to look at, that whole area that we just talked about around affordability and strengthening the lender's responsibility to do that. I think they're looking at the advertising as well, which is also one of the issues that Moolah have been caught under. But the key area which we would like to see the government move on is actually an interest rate cap, because at the moment they've got a suggestion that they will put a what they call a cost of credit cap, which is, in other words, if you borrow 100, you only pay back a maximum of 200, and that's only for high interest lenders, being above 50%. So we'd like to see an interest rate cap that goes way below that, maybe something near the 30% mark, or even a bit lower, so that people don't actually get caught in those high interest regimes to start with. Well, I view it as very much like an ambulance at the top of the cliff, you know, because if you once you get caught in that interest trap and the fees, then you spiral into debt and you spiral into all the challenges of for your own family, providing necessities for your family that entails. So we'd like to see an interest rate cap alongside what the government is proposing. But nonetheless, what they've started is good. It's just not complete, and we actually see it not having the true effect that they'd like to have by not having an interest rate cap as part of what they're proposing.
Mm. You mentioned advertisement. How, I suppose that's one of the key for these short-term lenders, and you know how to. This is how they manage to find clients, I suppose. Yeah. How do you sort of compete in that environment, and how could your organisation try and sort of catch these people that need finance before they get caught by these short-term lenders?
Yes, it's a good question. I mean, we don't have the budget to be able to compete to the same level. I mean, they put a lot out there in advertising and through various media channels. Our model of working is actually a little bit more focusing on what they call building the financial capability of clients. So our loans actually work through budgeters or financial mentors, as they are now called. So those are people who work in throughout New Zealand through budgeting services, and they support clients with budgeting who come to them for needing advice or support with their finances. So our loans really are a part of the whole idea of helping a client not only address their high interest debt, but actually be educated and supported in their whole budgeting, you know, the balancing of their budget and understanding around financial health for their family in a broader sense than simply just a loan. So we don't quite have the same model as Moolah and others do. We'd like to be out there a bit more, but our current model is really through financial mentors or budgeting services.
But you're hoping that with legislation, the world sort of short-term finances will be a bit healthier?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for lenders like ourselves, ethical lenders like ourselves, if hopefully the market for these high-cost predatory lenders shrinks and that people will therefore not get caught in that trap, they'll look for other sources and organisations like ourselves, if we can have that support to be able to scale up and look at how we can meet that increased demand, that would be part of the solution as well in society, to be able to provide ethical lending opportunities, safe, fair and affordable opportunities, rather than having the lenders out there who are not safe and not fair and not affordable.
So that was Robert Choi, and just before we were listening to Tim Barnett, both talking about the potential dangers of short-term lending, amongst other things. And while these interviews were playing, we got a text from Craig saying, "Why aren't the owners of these money lending companies named? Surely it would be a shameful industry to be involved in." Well, FinTech's director, so FinTech is the company that runs Moolah. His name is Steve Brooks, and he actually doesn't seem overly ashamed. He's the one that is responsible for that national 2020 big billboard that had that was giving offering support to Christopher Luxon with that sort of Dick Fizzle inspired morphing from John Key to Christopher Luxon. You might have seen that pass. Anyway, those the new ads are coming. Stay tuned.
95 BFM presents Nightmares on Wax. The down-tempo legend playing November 15th at the Hollywood Avondale.
You better get ready, cool and ready, put a rap steady, but now is the time.
One of the defining sounds of the 90s, Nightmares on Wax is back in Auckland following last year's rapturous headline set at Wonder Garden. Flip your lid for Nightmares on Wax, Friday, November 15th at the Hollywood Avondale. Get your tickets now from Just the Ticket.
What? What the hell?
Yeah, it's turned into a bit of a complicated install.
You've tipped out my undies drawer.
Yep.
My kimchi's gone everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a dog in the sink.
That's heat pumps, mate.
Don't leave it up to some cowboy. First Stop AC and Electrical are your first stop for heat pumps. The full range of models, top quality installations from an experienced team of installers. For a warmer, healthier home, First Stop AC and Electrical. Go to firststop.co.nz or call 0800 178 7867. That's 0800 178 7867.
Red Bull presents Bailey Wiley live at Galatos this Friday. Wiley is back in the game celebrating her new self-titled EP with a massive New Zealand tour. This one's going to be something special, so do not miss out. I thought if I loved you like that, you would love me right back. Bailey Wiley with special guests Haz and Milou plus Amoogie this Friday at Galatos. Get your tickets now from Under the Radar.
Heyo, what's in that soup? It looks like a mix of ingredients that, while delicious individually, are even better together.
Ha! That's not soup. It's the Student Radio Network.
Only the freshest ingredients go into the SRN Top 10. Te Te Kau o Rongo Rerekē o Aotearoa gathers up the highest quality, locally grown tracks from New Zealand's student radio stations and brings them together in a fragrant, flavourful and distinctly piquant mix. A chart show for those who prefer to order off menu. Tuesday after 6 on 95 BFM Drive or online at srn.nz. Brought to you by the Student Radio Network.
You are listening to 95 BFM, and as per every Tuesday, we are going to do the International Desk with myself. And we're going to talk about Greece today. A wind of change is actually about to blow over Greece. After 4 years of being governed by a coalition of left and far-left parties, Greeks have decided to elect the opposition in a snap general election that took place on Sunday. The centre-right party New Democracy scored 40% of the votes ahead of previous governing party Syriza, which only reached 31%. And the leader of New Democracy, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, is about to be sworn in as Greece's new prime minister. Mitsotakis is indeed going to oust popular figure and now former Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, who has been largely credited for driving Greece out of the colossal economic crisis it was engulfed in from 2009 onwards. His party Syriza, originally on the fringes of the political landscape, came to power in January 2015 amid a growing discontent of the population. Tsipras promised to end austerity policies then imposed by the European Union and the International Monetary Fund, the country's bailout creditors. It all started 10 years ago when Greece started feeling the effects of the global financial crisis of the year 2007 and 2008. The Greek economic crisis was mainly triggered by the dangerously high amount of sovereign debt, meaning the amount of money a country owes to creditors. In Greece's case, the EU and the IMF. Basically, Greece spent more money than it made, and for a while borrowed, but that led its budget deficit to become more than 15% superior to the country's GDP. And as a point of comparison, member states of the European Union are supposedly required to keep their budget deficit below 3% of the GDP. So in 2010, Greece announced that it would most likely not be able to pay off its debt, hoping the EU would forget it, but at the same time threatening the viability of the Eurozone. And to avoid that situation, the European Union and various private investors, such as banks, lent money to Greece, and a lot of it, about 320 billion euros, over the course of 8 years, so it could continue making payments and avoid default. The bailout would come at a high price, though. Greece would have to apply strict austerity measures. One of the harshest ones was a reform of the pension system, which meant that retired Greeks would have to would be given less money, while working Greeks would actually have to contribute more. And the second massive reform was the increase of a multitude of taxes, which led to a rise of unemployment and a record high rate of youth unemployment of 60%. These measures were also combined with a global lowering of wages, and Greece was requested to sell a lot of its nationalised assets, which certainly cost money in wages, but also constituted the only alternative in revenue to taxes. In the following years, Greece's economy both suffered and slightly recovered, but the austerity measures took their toll on the Greek people. And that's when Alexis Tsipras and Syriza come in the limelight. Tsipras based his entire campaign against the drastic measures and only 6 months into being prime minister, announced a referendum on austerity, promising that a no vote would give his country more leverage in future negotiations. A majority of Greeks voted no, 60% of them, creating global fear and causing banks to actually cap the allowance on withdrawals. But despite the no vote, the Greek parliament, with its Syriza majority, passed new austerity measures and agreed to a new bailout plan. Some called it pragmatism, others preferred the word treason. Zoe Konstantopoulou, former Syriza member who served as Speaker of the Hellenic Parliament, probably best embodies the disappointment that followed. For 4 years now, she's been very vocal against Tsipras and his reversal. When the referendum was passed in 2015, she refused to follow her party's directions and voted against further austerity measures. But Tsipras quickly dissolved the parliament and she was out. The radical left in government took a fairly similar path to what would have been expected of a centrist or right-wing party, and Tsipras agreed to cut pensions, broaden the tax base and privatise more companies. Many supporters have become heavily disillusioned, and Syriza's base is shrinking. The European elections of last May was the first clear sign. The left-wing coalition party only arrived second, 10 points behind New Democracy, maybe foreshadowing in retrospect Sunday's election results and forcing the snap election. But was it even a left-wing coalition anymore? Tsipras' ministerial cabinet is made out of politicians from a myriad of parties, including right-wing and liberal. Tsipras gained praises from the same neoliberals throughout Europe that had labelled him a populist for 5 years. The bailout programme ended on August 20th, 2018. What that means is that Greece will not be given any more money. But the country is not out of the crisis state, and repayments spread out until August 2060. Greece still has the highest youth unemployment rate in the European Union, recorded at 40% in January this year, and the global unemployment rate has maybe slowly decreased. Syriza recently boosted the minimum wage, but it all seems too little too late. The party campaigned on promises of tax relief for individuals and businesses and the creation of 500,000 new jobs within 4 years, but it doesn't seem to be enough to have convinced voters. Greeks offered their support to New Democracy, who promised a more drastic relief with bigger tax cuts and bigger increase of wages. And while the rest of Europe is experiencing a split in traditional politics and a massive rejection of the establishment in favour of fringe parties, Greece is doing the exact opposite. New Democracy leader Kyriakos Mitsotakis is the son of one of Greece's former prime minister. He was educated at Harvard and Stanford universities, and he did a brief stint as a financial analyst and consultant. The party itself is one of the two major traditional parties in Greece's modern history. It was in power between 2004 and 2009, and then again in 2011, and actively took part in both the demise and the attempt at saving the country. But the election of New Democracy and the return of dynasty politics in Greece is seen as actually just a return to normality in the country after a highly troubled decade. Is the 2019 New Democracy different from that of 10 years ago? As Syriza's discourse moved more and more towards the centre, to what New Democracy had advocated for so long, it had to find ways to stand out, and so it used the migrant crisis in Greece and the decades-long conflict with the Republic of Macedonia over the use of the name as points of difference again, and it seems to have worked. Because as much as the fallouts of the economic crisis Questions of nationalism and immigration have been at the heart of the recent Greek politics. And that's where Greece turns out not to be so different from the rest of Europe, after all. All right, I don't have a sting to finish this piece, but that was the International Desk talking about Greece. Remember that you can find all of these interviews that you heard throughout the show. You can find them again on the 95BFM website in the BCast section. While it was the break just before the International Desk, I had this phone call from someone who was asking me about this loan scheme that seemed very helpful, and that was the one of Robert Choi that gives interest-free and no-fee loans, and that is Ngā Tāngata Microfinance, for anyone out there who is experiencing a very difficult financial situation and could be helped by these guys. So just check out their website. I'm pretty sure they have a phone number, a landline that you can call to get some help. I'll put that in the description of the podcast if you ever make your way there. Anyway, that brings us to the end of our show for another week. Obviously, big thank you to all of those who spoke with us for the show today. And thank you to Mitch and Rahul for producing. And thank you to all of you who tuned in today. We'll be back next week. It won't be me hosting. It'll be Oscar again, but I'll be there with my international desk again. And up next is Jin with a 1-4. You're listening to BFM.
That was The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.